Okay, Joshua chapter 1, we're looking at verses 10 through 18, and this is where Joshua receives the order from the Lord to get ready to, you know, go up and cross into the land. And we're going to deal with the tribes that were stayed on the east side, and then the people's response. We're going to go back to chapter 1, verse 6, and just read those verses up to 10. This is the word that the Lord is giving Joshua as he's getting ready. He says, "Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous." And again, these ideas here that he's telling them is for him to be consistent, to be have integrity, to be faithful, to continue not to give up. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. And then when we talk about the law, that's Torah. And Torah means instruction. So when he says, and we mentioned this last week, when he talks about the law or the Torah, the instruction, he's not just talking about, you know, all the rules and regulations. He's talking about Genesis through Deuteronomy. He's talking about the Word of God, the Spirit, the instruction that God is revealing himself. So again, when we hear the word law, sometimes we think about all the regulations the Jews had to follow. And that was part of it. That was, there was revelation within that. But it's the whole concept of the written word. It'd be less like him telling us, you know, obey the Bible, you know, the written word, the revelation. Do not turn from it to the right or to the left, that you may be successful wherever you go. We talked about the word successful last week. Do not let the book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night. Again, that's talking about in your mind, in your heart, coming out of your mouth. And the word meditate is the ideal of speaking it, of continually having it on your mouth. And it's the word that means to like mutter, to mumble as you're not meditate, like emptying your thoughts like we have meditation today, but to have this constantly going through you. So it's your heart, your mind, your words. And we even talk about the words, it means in your attitude and the things you say, this word should be coming all the way through you, even into your words and into your lifestyle. Do not let it depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. And again, that's, again, not just saying the laws, the regulations, but that you have this right worldview, that you're seeing things the way the Lord designed them. Then you will be prosperous and successful. And again, that word prosperous, we talked about that last week, does not mean cash, money, you'll have a lot of money. It means whatever you've set out to do, you will be successful. You will complete it. You'll achieve the task. And Joshua's task was to lead the people across the Jordan into the land. And so wherever a person's task is, whatever they've been assigned to do, they'll be prosperous and successful. It has nothing to do with the concept of vast wealth and money, although if God's called you and led you into this area, that would be part of it. But it doesn't have to include money, buildings, houses, cars. It would include what God has called you to do. You would be successful in this endeavor that he set you on. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. That strong and courageous, it again, it's talking about the ideal of being committed and not turning back, not giving up. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. Now, this is the Lord and Joshua, and the Lord is speaking. Now, how he's speaking to him, we could, you know, assume it's some kind of a personal revelation, maybe at the tabernacle, like Moses was spoke to by the Lord there. I think it's more than just, you know, a little voice in his head. There's some kind of the Lord appearing to him. So Joshua ordered the officers of the people. This is verse 10 now. So Joshua ordered the officers of the people, go through the camp and tell the people, get your supplies ready. 3 days from now, you will cross the Jordan here to go in and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you for your own. And so he's going to take now the word the Lord spoke to him and give it to the officers. Now, here's where we're at right here. And you can see the map. We put Jericho right here. And that's where they're right straight across. Probably at that place right now that's being excavated, it's called Tal El Hamam, which is Sodom. And this is gaining a lot of traction academically that this is the location of Sodom, directly across from Jericho. This is where Beth was at. Remember, Abraham was at Bethel, and they looked to the east in the Kirkar. Kirkar means the disk. There's mountains here. There's mountains here. The water ran down into the Jordan, and there was continuous flow of water here. And this was the valley of God, or the garden of God. It was like the Nile, like Egypt, with all the water here. And this was a place where Sodom would have been. A lot of times it's down here, and there's really no biblical evidence because there's no way that they'd be looking down here, Abram looking down here. This is where it would have been. And they have found just this last week, I get an email on this, Steve Collins is the one that's excavating it. He's been doing it for like 15, 16 years. Even Rittmeyer, Lean Rittmeyer, who's great in Jerusalem, he was digging with Miser, back in 67, 68, when they first got possession of the Temple Mount, and he's still doing excavation work there, draws a lot of diagrams. He's been diagramming the gate, the walls, the layout of the city, and what they have found, they're just to end this, what they have found, they've got to go through all the layers, you know, the Iron Age, late, middle, early, and then they get down to the Bronze Age of where Sodom would have been. And what they've found is the household items, like they're in the palace right now, one of the palace areas. And again, it's not completely excavated. They just got to trench down to it. So it's not like just bulldozing it. But they've got down to it. And one of the emails last week, I shared it on Facebook, that just the common household items had been sitting out apparently, and they were smashed, but not just smashed, like collapsed. You know, you can tell when things have been destroyed by an earthquake, the walls collapse, the roof collapses, or an invasion where things are smashed, but things had been blown across the room, smashed against the wall, and then a lot of it had been melted and glazed with a high temperature. And it came from this direction right here, like this. And what it appears is, they've got all kinds of work on this, and you just got to study it and read it. There had been some kind of a solar burst that had blew up out of the Dead Sea. All this water covered the Kirkar and just wiped out all this area, and at the same time blew the city to smithereens and just ended civilization there. For the next like 400 or 600 years, nothing happened there. It was just dormant. And all this fertile crest or this fertile land here, because of the salt, just wiped it out. And then it receded back in. By Moses' time now, they've come up, and even the commentaries are saying Moses would have stopped right here. In fact, you're going to see next week, they're going to be their places called, again, this looks like a strange word, Shittim. That's what it's going to be called, is this is where it would have been camped at. And Steve Collins says at that layer of that time period, there had been a building, some of remains had been there, had built up since the days of Sodom, had built on top of it, like a tell. They just keep building, you know, the collapses, they just build up on top of it. And he can see the residences or the shelters that would have been there that Moses probably would have occupied when he's here, giving directions to the Israelites and Joshua from there. And then right before it left, the place was just torched as they came out. So that's probably where Joshua's at. And you can look that up and read about it. I've seen it in some commentaries. Steve Collins is convinced of it, and he's excavating. He's got boots on the ground right now. It's the season. It's the season of excavation right there. So when we see this in verse 10, go through the camp and tell the people, get your supplies ready. 3 days from now, you'll cross the Jordan. The phrase 3 days, it doesn't necessarily mean 1, 2, 3 days. It means, in the Hebrew, it means in the next couple of days, you know, the day after tomorrow. In other words, they're going to get these ideas, get their supplies ready, and then they're going to go ahead and begin approaching the Jordan River, who's in at flood state right now, and preparing to cross over. So they've got about, you know, this period of time to get ready. Now, what he says there, it says, I got on the notes there, officers is the Hebrew word, and you got the Hebrew word there, sotorim, most likely referring to administrative officials, some commentators say. So they're not like anything like military leaders, but at the same time, I noticed in Numbers 31, 48, the same word is used to refer to commanders, army commanders of thousands and commanders of hundreds. And so if it's administrative, again, Joshua is going to have military leaders, and our military is divided into groups, larger groups made up out of smaller groups, or these are administrative officials. But do notice he has some organization. I don't want to say some organization. It's highly organized, and the people are being sent out, go through the camp. Get your supplies ready. From now, you'll cross the Jordan here to go and take possession of the land the Lord your God is giving you for your own. One of the words in this, the whole book here, is the word give. Giving, given, and it's used several ways. It's the land that has been given. It's the land that he is currently giving them. It's land he promised to give. And so, in a sense, the way it's written, sometimes they've already got the land. It's already been given, obviously, in the promise. But yet they haven't taken possession of it. So yet they're going to be, he's in the process of giving it to them. So they're actively now receiving it. But yet, when they get there, it's still the land going to be given. Because when Joshua goes in there, he's not going to take the whole land. We've looked at the boundaries from Numbers, from Genesis. At the end, the boundaries that they take, it was not fully taken. Even in David's day, it wasn't fully taken. So actually, the Abrahamic covenant, the promise for this land, it was promised in Abraham's day. It was taken in Joshua's day, but yet it is still yet to be taken because the borders, they never completely fulfilled this promise. So this is a promise that's still hanging there. Joshua fulfilled it for a time. You can see the land shrinking and swelling throughout the ages. So I think even as we read Genesis and we read this, we realize we're still progressing the time where it's totally fulfilled. Now, interesting here in verse 12, but to the Reubenites, the Gadites, and the half-tribe of Manasseh, Joshua said, verse 13, remember the command that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you. Now here's a quote. Now Joshua is quoting Moses. The Lord your God is giving you rest and has granted you this land. Your wives, your children, and your livestock may stay in the land that Moses gave you east of the Jordan, but all your fighting men, fully armed, must cross over ahead of your brothers. You are to help your brothers until the Lord gives them rest, as he has done for you, and until they too have taken possession of the land that the Lord your God is giving them. After that, you may go back and occupy your own land, which Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you east of the Jordan towards the sunrise. That is what he's saying to the two and a half tribes. Those verses 12 through 14 are to those half tribes. And then in verse 16 it says, then they answered Joshua. Now again, you've got to decide, and commentators go both ways. Then they answered, is that the two and a half tribes responding? Or is that the whole group responding? And I think the best explanation is, there are two commands in here from Joshua. One is in verse 11, go throughout the camps. The officials go out and tell everybody, three days, we're getting ready to roll. But then he also sends a second message out to the two and a half tribes. We're also talking to you guys. You're not staying here. You're going with us. And then we go back to verse 16. Then they answer, which would be all the tribes together, the ones that heard the officials, and the two and a half tribes, they're all responding. So this is, again, you can decide it the other way. Maybe that's just the two and a half tribes, or I think it's all the tribes responding in unison, coming back and saying, or to the official saying, okay, we're on board, we're getting ready to go. And that would include the two and a half tribes. Now, about these two and a half tribes, we've got some things on the notes, and I want to spend a little bit of time looking at this. First of all, the word rest. The word rest means boundaries. Again, it doesn't, not literally rest, but it doesn't mean they're just sitting around not doing anything. When the land had rest, they had secure boundaries or borders, and they were functioning as a society. They were not at war, but they were at no war, but they were at some kind of rest with boundaries and a functioning society. So the two and a half tribes, over here, they've received rest. They've got their boundaries, and they're ready to set up their society. They're ready to function. They cannot stay there until all the other tribes have their rest or have their boundaries, war is over, and they're ready to function as a society. So that's the ideal of rest. Now, what happens here, if you look at the notes, just looking through here, the 2.5 tribes, look at the diagram, you've got Manasseh. Now, Manasseh is going to get property on both sides. That's the half tribe. The half tribe of Manasseh is going to be on the east, and you see on the left, there's also on the west side. And then you're going to have Gad is going to have the territory that's going to include kind of where Joshua and the people are at right here. And then Reuben is going to go down into the land of Moab. And you can see the boundaries right there. So Gad and Reuben are going to stay over there. What has taken place, as Moses led the people up around Edom, then up through Ammon and or Moab and into Ammon, they conquered the kings there. The kings rebelled against them, and so they conquered them. They're just wanting to just pass through. We're not even here to take your land. But they rebelled against them, so it's like, well, you're going to make us fight. And that was the idea. We talked about that. We're just going to pass through, but if you want to fight, if you want to gamble, you want to play, you want to lay your cards on the table, we'll play. And if we win, we take what you bet. And you're betting your land right now. You attack Moses, you're betting your property. And so they lost the war, so Moses gets the property. Same thing here. They wanted to fight. Are you sure you want to fight? Because if you lose, we're taken. We're not going to just give it back to you. And they won, and they're going to keep it. And that's going to come up later, 300 years later, in Jephthah. Remember, we talked about Jephthah in the book of Judges, where they're saying, hey, this is really our land. And Jephthah says, well, you know, we took it from you. You bet it, and we took it fair and square. So now, it's great land. In fact, the best pasture land is going to be right up here in Gilead, on the east side of the Jordan. That's where we're talking on Tuesday nights about the Arameans fighting with the northern tribes of Israel for this land, days of Ahab and Jeroboam II, during those two dynasties, because this is where the trade routes ran. Even the prophets make fun of the women of Israel. They call them the fat cows of Bashan, because they're just so luxurious, eating the grass and just lounging around. And the prophet actually insults the women because they're so lazy, like the cows of Bashan, because there's just such an easy lifestyle. So this is great land. So when these tribes saw this, we're going to read the verses, they said, you know, hey, listen, we're close enough. This is good land. And let's go to real quickly, and you've got this right now in Numbers 32, so you can kind of see this, because this became, and you can kind of see Moses kind of, here it is, Numbers chapter 32. After all these things had taken place, it says, the Reubenites and Gadites, in chapter 32 of Numbers, had very large herds and flocks, saw the lands of Jazer and Gilead, that's this land right here, were suitable for livestock. Indeed it is. So they came to Moses and Eleazar. Eleazar has replaced Aaron. That's Eleazar is Aaron's son. Aaron's died. So it's late. I mean, we're right here just the last few days of this journey. So they came to Moses and Eleazar, the priest, and to the leaders of the community and said, and there they mentioned all these, the land of the Lord subdued before the people of Israel are suitable for livestock, and your servants have livestock. If we have found favor in your eyes, they said, let this land be given to your servants as our possession. Do not make us cross the Jordan. Now, that to Moses, that sounds a little bit like what he heard 40 years ago. We're fine here in the wilderness. Don't make us go up and take the land. And you can see Moses' response. Moses said to the Gadites and the Reubenites, shall your countrymen go to war while you sit here? Why do you discourage the Israelites from going over into the land the Lord has given them? This is what your fathers did when I sent them from Kadesh Barnea to look over the land. After they went up to the valley of Eshcol and viewed the land, they discouraged the Israelites from entering the land the Lord had given them. In other words, you're saying this is fine. Well, what happens if the other 10 tribes say, yeah, we think so too. Let's just divide this up 12 ways and we can just stay here. Moses stops this right at the beginning and says, we're not having no part of this. No, don't even talk. You're going to discourage everybody. So then he goes on, he reads more about it and talks about being promised to Abraham, Isaac, talks about Caleb and him going into the land. Verse 14, and here you are, a brood of sinners, standing in the place of your fathers and making the Lord even more angry with Israel. If you turn away from following him, he will again leave all of his people in the desert, and you will be the cause of their destruction. Moses says, I just spent 40 years in the wilderness because you wouldn't take the land the first time. I'm over here ready to send you in the land. I don't even get to go in because you made me so mad. Now you're wanting to trade this thing in. He says, you'll spend another 40 years in the wilderness. Then they came up to him and said, so it looks like there was some negotiation going on here. They make the suggestion. Moses shoots it down, probably breaks a couple of tablets or something. And then they go back and they go, well, you know, let's consider this again. And they come back again. It may have been taking place all at one time, or there may have been some negotiations. Then they came up to him and said, we would like to build pens here for our livestock and cities for our women and children. But we are ready to arm ourselves and go ahead of the Israelites until we have brought them to their place. In other words, okay, we see what you're saying. You're afraid that we're going to discourage everybody and just sit over here and, you know, send you encouragement, you know, care packages or something. There's no, let us build pens for us. You know, let us start settling in here right now. Let our women stay here. We'll build homes for them. But we will come across and we will fight just like all the other tribes. Meanwhile, our women, okay, verse 18, we will not return to our homes until every Israelite has received his inheritance. We will not receive any inheritance with them on the other side. We're giving up all of our inheritance. We're not going to take our share over here. In other words, there'll be more for everybody here if we get ours here. But we'll help them get that. We'll not receive any inheritance with them on the other side of the Jordan because our inheritance has come to us on the east side of the Jordan. Then Moses said to them, if you will do this, if you will arm yourself before the Lord for battle, again, there's the word Yahweh, if you will arm yourself before Yahweh for battle, and if all of you will go armed over the Jordan before the Lord until he has driven his enemies out before him, then when the land is subdued before the Lord, you may return and be free from your obligation to the Lord and to Israel, and this land will be your possession before the Lord. But if any of you fail to do this, and it goes on and on and on, then all this problem is going to have this. Anyway, there's that agreement. You can see it again in Deuteronomy. And that is what Joshua is referring to here in these verses. I'm going back to Joshua now. He's quoting Moses right there, reminding him, because now Joshua's the one that's responsible to get these people across the Jordan. And he just sends out two of them. And he sends out the officers out to all the tribes, but he sends a special message to the Reubenites and the Gadites and the half-tribe of Manasseh. Again, Manasseh is going to take part of the land there also. And he says, remember, I'm in verse 13 of chapter 1 of Joshua, remember the command that Moses, the servant of the Lord, gave you. This, the Lord your God is giving you rest and has granted you this land. In other words, it's been approved by the Lord. You can stay here. Then he goes on in verse 14, your wives, your children, and your livestock may stay in the land that Moses gave you east of the Jordan, but all your fighting men, and again, the word fighting men, I got that written down in the notes right here. In verse 14, it says, ready for battle or formation. It literally means a five-fold arrangement of army troops. All your fighting men, or the five-fold arrangement. The idea here is all your fighting men, you can see other places, would probably refer to those that are in groups, maybe lined up in groups of 50, going across, forming, you know, 50, then groups of 100, and then 1,000, and they're lined up in their battle arrangement. Now, an interesting note right here, it says, all your fighting men, that says right there, it's interesting, in Numbers 26, I mean, just a few months ago from this time right here, they found 110,000 men capable of bearing arms. But Joshua, chapter 4, verse 13, is going to show that only 40,000. So there's going to be 110,000 men able to bear arms, but when they actually, and they're going to lead them across. They're going to go across. Only 40,000 are going to do this. So do we have a problem here? And again, you can say, well, it looks like, you know, looks like a good, you know, 70,000 bailed out. But what maybe took place, because this is talking about the best. The word there that is used is your best soldiers. This would be the youngest, the strongest, the ones that are most viable fighters, and the others would then stay back to, again, you're not going to abandon the entire community, all the women, all the children, all the animals are just going to be abandoned. These guys would have stayed back there. So again, that's probably not a problem. It's probably just common sense. That's how many we're going to go across. This reminds me of, I was doing some ancestral work a couple months ago, around Christmas time, and I had a grandfather, great-grandfather, everybody had a great-grandfather fight in the Civil War. I mean, it's not that big a deal. I mean, it's like, oh, I had a great-grandfather fight. So everybody did. And, I mean, I talked about that, how you go back far enough. Everybody had someone fight in the Revolutionary War. I mean, you just may not know their name, but you did. But I had one. I've got his picture. It's a picture from 1865. It's my great-great-grandfather. My great-grandmother wrote on the bottom of it. saying something about him. So I've got his picture. So I knew he was, and I found his tomb, and I found his Civil War documents. But in the process of doing the genealogy, I found two other great-great-grandfathers that fought in the Civil War. One was, I think there's three more, because one was a father whose daughter married someone, which also fought in the Civil War. But one fought for the South, one fought for the Union, and then his daughter married the other side, which is kind of interesting. But the whole point is one of them was listed as being in the service for like the whole, like a 5-year period. But when they went out, he was like 40-some years old, so he didn't go to battle. He stayed back and was in charge of, feeding the horses or something like this. And so that would make sense right here. He still was in the Civil War. His widow still got the pension when he died. We still have the pension notes. And so when he was still considered to be in the military, but they're not going to send him into battle because, I mean, you're dead meat. You just stay here and feed the horses and send them up when they're ready or whatever his job was. So that would make sense to me that's why those numbers are different. All the able fighting men are going to be going up and fighting. I'm going to grab a different eraser. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, the special ops. Yeah, next week we're going to get a special ops. We're going to send two spies into the land. I think that's all we've got right there. Now, just take a look at that map and see, again, Manasseh, how much land they're going to have, and Ephraim. Manasseh and Ephraim are the sons of Joseph. See, there's no name of Joseph on this map. But Joseph is going to get the double portion. So his two sons, Ephraim and Manasseh, each get territory. And then, of course, you can see Judah and Simeon. But on the 2.5 tribes, Reuben and Gad, they're going to stay on the other side. And that's where their land, that's where their inheritance is going to be. Going back to the text here, Joshua chapter 1, looking in verse, let's say 16. And here's the ending now. Then they answered, and you decide who they are. Is it the 2.5 tribes saying, okay, we'll go to war? Or is it just everybody? I think it's everybody. Now, this is interesting what takes place here. Then they answered Joshua. I think this is in response to verse 10 and 11 when he sends out the officers and in response to what he told the 2.5 tribes. Then they respond to Joshua, whatever you have commanded us, we will do. And wherever you send us, we will go. In other words, they're now, remember, Moses commissioned him. The Lord chose him to be the leader. You see God speaking to Joshua here early in chapter 1. And now the people are recognizing him as the leader. So it seems like there's been a smooth transition of power. This could have been a terrible time of the transition of power. Just imagine, the time that takes place after Solomon hands power over to Rehoboam. There was a civil war, and that's where Jeroboam comes from, and you got the two kingdoms. It splits. This could have been a split right here. You could have had the 2.5 tribes stay over there and not want to come. So Joshua's navigating his way through this, and the people are cooperating. I mean, it's a nice We just assume it's going to be an easy transition because of Moses and the Bible, but this could have been a revolt. And Joshua or Moses had warned them, if you don't go across, we'll be another 40 years in the wilderness. He didn't say 40 years, but the Lord will abandon us again. Then they answered, whatever you have commanded us to do, wherever you send us, we will go. Now this is, and that's how, okay, thank you very much. That's good. That's positive. But now look at this. This sounds really, really good. Just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Now at first it's like, I appreciate that. Wait a minute. It's like, you've seen the, like as a school teacher, you've seen these kids in you know, sixth grade in the classroom with their other teachers, and then they come to my class, and I've watched them misbehave and get mouthy and do whatever they do. Then they come to my class and say, now, are you going to participate? Just like we do, we will obey you just like we do the other teachers. Thank you. It's like, wait, I've seen you obey the other teachers. Now, we're not going to do that here. It's going to be different in here. And so at first, it's like, just as we fully obeyed Moses. And you can go way back to when Moses arrived to deliver them out of Egypt, their fathers. And then you've got they're grumbling at the Red Sea. You had them, the rebellion at giving of the commandments of the golden calf. Then all the way through with complaining about the manna, complaining about the water. They got, you know, the rebellion they had after the prophet came down from the north. I forget his name right offhand, from Peora. And then they ended up going and having committing adultery, and thousands of them died. So, I mean, it was 40 years of rebelling. That's why they spent 40 years in the wilderness, because they would listen to Moses. And so when he said, I mean, just take that in mind, just as we fully obeyed Moses, so we will obey you. Only may the Lord your God be with you as he was with Moses. Now, in my NIV Bible, it's got the word only in it. Some NIV, the newer translations, I don't think has this word only in it. The English Standard Version has it in it. And I've got that written down here at the bottom of the page, chapter 1, verse 17. Only, it's the word in the Hebrew, R-A-Q, if that's useful, which it's not. Before imperfect verb, and I got this right out of a commentary, so don't be impressed. Don't think I figured this out. But before an imperfect verb, this word, as it is here, expresses something which either contradicts or varies from that which precedes it. The point is, Joshua is not going to be able, just like, in other words, only, in other words, this is what we're going to do, only. Now, in opposition to this, only, meaning whatever we said, is not going to be the issue. In other words, just as we obeyed Moses, we're going to obey you. Thank you for your commitment. Is that what they said? It's more like they're saying, we will do whatever we can do, but our production is going to be just like Moses got. We're the same people. So, only. In other words, contrary to our nature, contrary to what we're going to be able to do, only, and this is what it says right here, may the Lord, may Yahweh your God be with you as he was with Moses. In other words, we got here because Yahweh was with Moses, not because we obeyed. So, we'll obey you just like we obeyed Moses, but understand, not because of us, but based on something else, Yahweh is with you, Joshua, just like he was with Moses, and everything will be fine. Or we can also see this, and then we read on, it says, whoever rebels against your word and does not obey your words, whatever you may command them, will be put to death. Only be strong and courageous. Another way of seeing that is if you, Joshua, have evidence, if you're going to follow the Lord, if you are following Yahweh, and how would we know? We would see evidence of it. If you're following Yahweh, we will be able to follow you. We'll get this done. In other words, it's interesting. Both Joshua and the people have learned this lesson at this point from the wilderness. We're going to do the best we can. We will obey just like Moses, which isn't a lot. Only Yahweh is going to have to do it. Joshua, you will be the man, but you're going to have to follow Yahweh and see evidence of Yahweh in your life, in your leadership. Because Yahweh is the one that's going to do it. And then they say, anyone that disobeys, anyone who breaks this mold, will be put to death. And what's interesting is the first thing that happens is when they get in, Ahab ends up Achan ends up stealing from Jericho. That's way up in chapter 7. And ends up getting stoned to death. So they're going to have a good start to this. And then they tell him, only be strong and courageous, which is now the third time Joshua's been told, be strong and courageous. Moses told him that. The Lord told him that. And now the people are, be strong and courageous. Do not give up. Do not be discouraged. You're going to have to be consistent in this. Just get going and don't look back. That's where they end. Now, in the next chapter, they're getting ready now. You see what's taking place now. The people are getting ready during this three-day period, you know, the day after tomorrow or the next 2 days. The people are getting ready, getting their provisions ready, which would include having and using the manna that's available. Joshua's going to send in two spies. He's going to send the spies in. We'll pick this up next week. And they're going to go in and take a look at the land. They're going to end up at Rahab's place. And they're going to be not going to be good spies, apparently. I mean, they got caught. The king knows they're there. It says here in the text, we say Moses sends them secretly. Now, that's really like, you don't need to say the spies were sent secretly because spies are always sent secretly. Not just secretly to Jericho, but maybe to the people. Joshua maybe is not telling everybody, hey, we're sending two spies. But two guys slipped out of camp. They ford the Jordan themselves. They find a place that they can go across and walk across the Jordan at this time. And they get in the land. So no one else knew this. This is just for Joshua to get some information. And so we're going to talk about that next week. A lot of interesting things. So now we've got Rahab. We've got the walls of the city. You've got the spies being found out. You've got just loads of evidence in these stories that this was written during the Bronze Age. There's things that are detailed in here that archaeologists can trace back and match up. This is the time period, like the treaties match, the use of the materials match, the identity of the king of Jericho fits. These were city-states. He's not the king. The king used to be Pharaoh, was ruling over this, but there would be people that were in charge of different territories. This recorded in letters that they're sending asking for help from the Egyptians. The Egyptians have lost control of this area, and so these kings are left by themselves, or these city-states are left by themselves. It all matches the Bronze Age. Now, my point for this is the critics of the scriptures that say, well, this was written many years later, the Deuteronomists that were writing back in Babylon, just recording things and making things up. They do not have that kind of knowledge in Babylon about this time period. The way the land is described by Moses gives the impression that Moses was familiar with the land, and having been trained by the Egyptians, he may have traveled in the land. He may have gone and negotiated. He may have been an ambassador, just like Daniel was in his day. So Moses was familiar with things that only Moses would have known in Moses' time period, and his information matches what archaeology and cultures from that time period show, the writings. The same thing here. This adventure that they're going on matches perfectly with the Bronze Age. It cannot, I mean, the evidence is there. It cannot have been something that was forged in Babylon. If you're in the 1800s, you can say that. But now that archaeology and linguistics and other writings have surfaced, you cannot say that anymore. People are still saying that because they want to be minimalist. They do not want these stories to be authentic documents. But just like Daniel, you know the story of Daniel. We've talked about it. Belshazzar, the last king of Babylon. It's like no one had ever heard of Belshazzar. They knew it was just a fabrication up until the late 1800s. The book of Daniel was discredited as being something written probably during the Maccabean time period, because it was historically inaccurate, because this Belshazzar, no one's even heard of him, and he was never the last king of Babylon. Nabonidus was the last king of Babylon. Everyone knows this, except archaeology, and you know the story. They went in and they found that I've got a mold of it, a little imitation of it. replica, thank you, a replica of the Nabonidus scroll or seal. It's a cylinder, just like the Cyrus seal, where it had, they would write, instead of writing just on flat tablets, they began to write on circles, so that like you could read it like this. You could roll it like you're scrolling through an iPad or something. You could roll it and read the text. And in there, he talks two different times, two different cylinders. Nabonidus mentions his son, Belshazzar. And he had gone south and left Babylon in control of his son, Belshazzar, who was then the king, because the other king, his father, had gone south. They've also found an inscription that says Nebuchadnezzar, or Belshazzar, king of Babylon, has been found. Now, that completely undermines the idea that anyone later could have wrote the book of Daniel, because no one knew this information. It had to be written by an eyewitness, because the reason no one records it is because Belshazzar is killed the night the Persians invade, and he's eliminated from history, and no one sat down and wrote down the bloody details, because they're just eliminated. Daniel was there, watched it, was a part of the whole scene, and he records it, only to be mocked through the modern histories until archaeology confirms this book had to be written by someone that was there looking at it, because now archaeology, we dig it up out of the dirt, there it is. And so that's continually what we see in this Old Testament, is continually to understand the time periods it was written, what was going on, confirms that these were documents that were recorded at that time, which makes it even more exciting as we get into this next chapter 2 and see the spies going in and interacting with the society that is there in Jericho at that time period. Then you've got the walls. The walls have been excavated and certain things have been discovered. There's been arguments back and forth about the walls of Jericho, some confirming, some not confirming, but we'll talk about that as we go through chapter 2. Well, chapter 4. But chapter 2, we're going to go see the spies. I'll pray, and then we're free to go. Thank you for being here. Father, we thank you for your word. We thank you for your truth. We do ask that we would continue to grow in our understanding, that we'd allow these things to penetrate our hearts, that we may meditate on them also in our minds, in our hearts, and be able to live them out in our lives. Again, we thank you for your truth. We ask again that we may be empowered by your Spirit at this time in history. In Jesus' name we pray. Amen.